Good afternoon, Council. The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now back in session.
Good afternoon, everyone. Today is December 2nd, 2020. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. This is the third of three cases on our oral argument calendar today. File number A20579. Is it Knutson versus Knutson or Knutson? Counsel, I hope you will correct me if I mispronounced your client's name. A few things before we begin. Please mute your microphone if you are not speaking. The marshal is showing a running clock of your time. Please pay attention to the amount of time left in your argument. I'd ask that you identify yourself and your client before you begin your argument for the record. Each party will have 15 minutes for their primary argument. The appellant will have an additional 5 minutes for rebuttal. And with that, counsel, you may proceed.
May it please the court, opposing counsel, my name is attorney Jacob Burkholz and I represent underlying petitioner and appellant Nicole Knutson, now Nicole Campbell. Appellant's primary issues on appeal in this case, I'll take them as they are in my brief. Number one, the house was proven to be non-marital. I don't think the facts are really in dispute as it relates to the house. The house and the deed were completely transferred solely into Ms. Campbell's, Ms. Knutson's name as it was changed solely, all prior to the marriage. I want to keep in mind the standard on non-marital property is, was there proof by a preponderance of the evidence that it was non-marital? And it absolutely was. In fact, there was no counterproof or evidence or testimony or otherwise presented by Mr. Knutson at trial on the house. The house, as it was transferred, was by deed and it was a gift from Ms. Campbell's parents. There was no dispute of that. Again, Mr. Campbell testified to that at trial. Where the case got murkier on the house, but again, not unclear, was that there was a gifting strategy. Again, that was not disputed at trial. There was no counter evidence against that testimony. Mr. Campbell, this would be a senior father to Nicole Campbell, testified, and we presented documentation and evidence that in fact it was a mortgage on paper and that mortgage was forgiven. I point to, in my brief, undisputed testimony that would contradict some of the court's findings to show there was clear error. And what that means is that specifically neither Mr. Knutson nor Ms. Campbell during the marriage paid anything for the house. There was no payments on principal. Both parties conceded that. There was no evidence there was any money paid on this mortgage.
Well, each party conceded that party didn't pay. He said he didn't pay. She said she didn't pay. Fair. I guess he didn't say what she did. As I read the record, I mean, I think that the issue with the house part of the is, I mean, there was wasn't there a revised sort of house loan in 1998 when the parties were married that laid out prospective principal payments, et cetera. So is that not right? Something called a Nicole house loan on 1/1/98. And then there was $15,000 forgiveness. And then there was supposed to be future principal payments and so on.
I think it was all recitation. Mr. Campbell, father, just wrote these documents up for his gifting purposes. There was never a new mortgage, never money given to the parties. There was no money exchanged hands. This was all on paper for kind of a gifting strategy that was testified to. So the fact, you know, I understand on paper it was written that way, but it never happened. So just because non-party wrote a document that purported to be a mortgage, it never happened. And so you can't create marital equity out of nothing is the principle here that can't be overcome. So the house was given and transferred and that's all that ever happened. And on paper, this note is forgiven with gifting so that when he applies on his federal gift tax return, he can write it down that he gave it away in incremental fashion.
So he doesn't. And did he, were there record, because she would have to show that he essentially, her dad gave her money that she used then to repay it, right? he gave her non-marital money that she used to repay the loan to him. And the district court's problem seemed to be, well, although there was careful, documentation on a 15,000 forgiveness, there's sort of a big blank on what happens afterwards, except that ultimately there's a satisfaction of the mortgage. But there isn't, record of annual gifts or so on after the 15,000, is there?
I believe there is. I don't have all the exhibits in front of me, but I believe that's pretty clear in the record that there was a specific series of transactions and a pattern of was $5,000 or $10,000 dollars each year by each of them. That was testimony too, if it's not in the exhibits.
By each of whom? Maybe you could specify what that is. That would be helpful. So what is the record evidence that there were payments or, money from dad given to her that she paid the loan on?
Maybe I'm misunderstanding. Dad never gave money.
Right. How did she pay the loan back?
She didn't.
So it was just a forgiveness, and you're saying that each forgiveness was documented annually. Correct. Where were those annual what are those annual documents of the forgiveness? Or not annual, but wherever, whatever rate they were. What are they exactly?
I don't have the exhibit number offhand. I believe that's in the trial record.
Okay.
Could I ask you this? Because you'll agree that we have to defer to the court's assessments of credibility. Correct, as a reviewing court?
Generally, yes.
Okay, and I'm looking at the supplemental findings of fact, conclusions of law, and amended judgment. And if you look at finding number 5 there, the court dealt with the argument that the court made no analysis. And the court indicated, well, yes, I did. But the court did analyze testimony from Wise's father regarding donative intent and found specifically that the evidence vague and not sufficiently credible to establish that the remaining $45,000 of the $60,000 satisfaction of judgment was gifted to Wife. Doesn't that pretty much bind what we do here as a reviewing court if they found that evidence was not credible?
No, because there was never, we have to start from the beginning. From a legal standpoint, the house was entirely transferred prior to even this alleged mortgage to Ms. Newton Campbell. And she had the house. It was her house with no money exchanged hands. Then the question becomes, was there ever a mortgage? For that finding to be given any deference by the reviewing court, the underlying facts would have to be true. For example, was there ever a mortgage? Well, the answer is no.
I mean, are you disputing there was a promissory note? I mean, they call it a mortgage, but they're treating it as if it were a mortgage.
There were notes that were forgiven, drafted and satisfied on paper.
But isn't that the issue, whether they were forgiven or not? Because you have number one documents that seem to indicate that. That these were payments due and owing, and you have the court indicating that he did not find the testimony of Wise's father credible. So, how does the court get around that? Because, that's the key issue, isn't it? Whether this debt was forgivable or forgiven.
You can't create debt that was never money given. So, you can't have a note. So if I go to a bank and borrow money, I'd have to get the money and then pay it back or get it forgiven. And that never happened. The parties they never got money. And that transaction happened in the beginning. So
isn't a promissory note a debt? I guess I'm not understanding your argument. There's no dispute that there was a valid promissory note. Am I correct?
Well, I would say it's illusory in the sense that if he gave money to, he gave the house, meaning he, Sheldon Campbell, gave the house to Nicole Campbell and forgave that if you want to call it that. The transfer all happened prior to marriage, but if there was this, again, the court says we're going to give deference to this series of gifting, all of that gifting happened. The gifting was from Sheldon Campbell to Miss Campbell. So the question is, if the court says, well, I don't find the forgiveness, well, then what's the alternative? The alternative is you can't create marital equity. That's the dilemma of the court's logic. It cannot create marital equity, even if the court says it's got a promissory note.
What if there were, let's assume that the house is given with a loan attached to it. So there's an obligation on it to wife before the marriage. And then during the marriage, the loan is paid off jointly by both parties. Is that house still marital property for wife?
Whatever amount was paid during the marriage through marital money would create marital equity. Right. So a gift.
And is the problem here that there's a satisfaction of mortgage? Her father was not found credible by the court. So there's a suggestion that it was paid and that she didn't trace the payment to her non-marital funds to pay it. Instead, it was untraced. Isn't that the problem? You're saying it was forgiven, but if the district court didn't find that credible and found instead that it was paid.
If the court looks carefully at all the record and the testimony, Sheldon Campbell testified he never received money. So for that logic to apply and for the court, which didn't make those findings, he never received money. Neither party paid money. So the fact that both parties say they did not pay Sheldon Campbell, that again, logic would break down. I agree if that were true, that each party had a history of making principal payments or had made any payments to Sheldon, and then was determined to be uncredible in his forgiveness, perhaps. But that didn't happen. None of those legs of the logic stand true when you look at the facts between Sheldon's, Campbell's testimony, Nicole Knutson's testimony, and Mr. Knutson's testimony. No one disputes that no money exchanged hands, nothing was paid. So no marital equity can be created. Even if someone is found uncredible, that doesn't create, that's the burden of proof argument I kept making to the court. The court just simply said, I don't find Mr. Campbell credible, but you can't create marital equity without a marital contribution. And that's the underlying fact that this court has to reverse on. Mr. Knutson is getting marital equity from nothing.
Well, I'm reading the court's order, and it seems like the court is basically saying this, that there was a promissory note, that payments were set up, but they did not find, the court did not find credible about the donative intent regarding those payments. And that because the claim is non-marital, that it's your client's burden of proof on this issue. And that based on this analysis and the fact that it was satisfied and there was no showing or sufficient showing of donative intent, that you failed to meet that burden of proof. Is that an erroneous way to analyze this?
Yes.
Okay, and why?
Because it skips a critical step. And that's because the house was already transferred to, by deed, to prior to marriage. And so, and no dispute that this house was already in her name. And then in order to create a promissory note or create debt for a house that, remember, Mr. Campbell didn't even own at that point. There was no consideration given. That money would have had to have exchanged hands. If that had happened, then I would agree with the court. If the parties had received a benefit from Mr. Campbell. And just to go back to the court's point, there is a ledger showing a history of all the forgiveness and the detailed timelines, Your Honor. So if the court does see that detailed timeline in the forgiveness ledger, so even...
And what is that? What exhibit is that? What are you referring to?
I don't have it.
If you don't know, that's okay. I thought you had come up with it. Okay, go ahead.
So I just want to point out that logic is based on the original faulty assumption that I pointed out to the district court, that this was somehow marital property. Where is the presumption of marital property being created? It can't exist in the case. There's numerous cases that say that the transfer or the gift of money or the loan or the equity has to have happened during the marriage. There was no payments. There was no receipt of money, and the transfer didn't happen. Therefore, what the court did was use, and I think it's in the findings, a presumption of marital property, and then in turn said, we didn't prove the gifting. That would be true if the house was marital property. That logic from the district court, but it never was, nor is anyone saying it was. So the mere fact that didn't find Campbell credible or non-credible can't avoid the law. I realize I don't have much time left, if I may move on. The variety of the other issues are the Schmitz formula. Schmitz formula, even if the court were to suggest that there were some issues with the house, there has to be a Schmitz formula applied, which again, the court didn't apply. That's required as a matter of law. There's also the down payment on the farm. That the Schmitz formula was not applied, even though it's undisputed that wife received the $20,000 non-marital payment. That was not applied in the case. And again, court makes a suggestion about proving market forces. There's no case law or logic behind that. That's all of real estate in the entire country. It increases as a matter of time. All the experts' testimony supports that. I realize I'm out of time.
Yes, counsel. Are there any other questions from the panel? Counsel, you'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal, all right? Thank you. Counsel, you may proceed. Mr. Bellig, you're on mute. There you go.
Good afternoon. My name's Dan Bellig. I'm attorney for respondent Adam Knutson. I think I'll start just by tracing the discussion you had with my colleague here. The first argument that's being made today is that the entire house was transferred prior to the marriage by a deed. Now, it may have been transferred by deed, but it wasn't transferred without some sort of obligation. And we know that because Sheldon Campbell testified that he would not be transferring the entire property to her at one time because he was seeking to avoid gift tax. All right. And that was the whole point of his gifting plan. And if he would have done that, and this is his testimony, if he would have transferred the whole house valued at $60,000 or whatever other number they were claiming, he would have had to pay a gift tax in the year that he made the transfer. And he said, he testified that he paid no such tax. And so just before the marriage, then it appears that they've documented that this house was in fact subject to an obligation. Now, I think—
So the deed, okay, if you can get there, the deed precedes the marriage, the loan precedes the marriage. What evidence, why, and there's documentation of $15,000, I guess, paid. The remainder of it, the $45,000 on that obligation, if it's, what evidence, why isn't it clearly erroneous to find that that was not a forgiveness by the dad to his daughter?
All right.
Representing non-marital property then.
Yes. So what the court did here is it credited the contemporaneous documents versus the live testimony of the father in support of his daughter. So there are two exhibits here that I think the court will find key on this issue. The first is Exhibit 10. And that's the January 1998 letter from mom and dad to Nicole saying that they can no longer follow the original plan of gifting the home to her. And that, quote, from now on, we will not be able to reduce the amount of the loan as a gift. If it is workable with you, we could have a loan payment schedule of at least an annual principal payment and a monthly interest payment. End quote. And the reason for that, again, was tax reasons. The IRS must have no longer allowed write-downs of loans as a gift. And then Nicole signs that. And along with that, you have Exhibit 218. And that's the key document as well. And that's the revised house loan. And what you see documented there is the history of the loan and its reductions in balance. And the first one is acknowledged, as it says on page one of 218, as a gift. It says gift, $15,000, okay? You turn to the next page and you look at all the other reductions, there's interest paid, and then instead of saying gift, it says principal payment. So he's making a distinction in this document between a gift and a principal payment. You also have to couple that with his testimony that he was a good businessman. He documented large gifts in writing, and they produced no other written acknowledgments of a gift with respect to the home other than that original $15,000.
Maybe I just don't understand something here. Are you trying to argue that there was no gift so that the loan continued? I mean, your argument has to be that it was satisfied by payments from the couple, right?
Correct.
I mean, not that the loan remains outstanding.
Correct. The loan.
So what evidence is there that the couples made payments, and why did the district court not clearly err in concluding that together they made that they disposed of the loan?
Because Exhibit 218 acknowledges that a principal payment was made. And Sheldon Campbell testified.
In how much money? The principal payment of how much?
The remainder of the balance. It's all on that ledger. So for example, January 1st, 1998, principal payment of $10,000. Then we go down and January 1st of 1999, principal payment $10,000. And then it's eventually satisfied through principal and interest payments in 2001. Okay. So Sheldon, in his contemporaneous documents, is contradicting himself and acknowledging that he's received principal payments. Now, Adam didn't make those payments. He acknowledged that. But he testified he didn't know what Nicole did with her money. So the court recognized that there's something afoot here. Sheldon's trying to do two different things. One, he's trying to avoid a gift tax, and that's what all these documents are showing. And so he could no longer, and when the law changed then, he had to document that he was no longer making gifts. All right. But then they're trying to come in and say, no, they were gifts. Well, their testimony at trial contradicts his contemporaneous records. And so the court credited the contemporaneous records over the self-serving testimony at trial.
Well, can I go back to an argument made by Mr. Burkholz? I mean, he's basically saying there was no marital interest here because this house was given to her by warranty deed 2 years before the marriage. So there was really... you know, there didn't need to be any marital funds paying this alleged mortgage, and that the wife really didn't need a mortgage deed because it had already been transferred to her, and that her father at that point didn't even have a legal right to do the transfer. So, I mean, how do you respond to that? Because I don't think those facts are disputed in terms of the facts underlying, you know, the transfer of this house.
Right. So you can give someone a deed, but that doesn't mean that they're receiving the property free and clear. So just because she received a deed at some point does not mean there's no obligation on the property. In fact, Sheldon testified at transcript 296, that he always considered it a sale because I never believe in giving anyone anything that they didn't work for. So he considers this transaction not a gift, but a sale. And then he always not acknowledges that he documents large gifts, but they couldn't produce any documentation other than the $15,000. And then he goes on and he testifies that he didn't pay any gift tax in the year that he transferred the property. Well, the transfer of property with a value of $60,000, or at some point Sheldon claims that it was $100,000, he would have far exceeded the gift tax limitation and would have been required to pay tax that year. So we know from those facts that the property, although transferred by deed, was not transferred without some kind of an obligation. And we also know that from his original gifting plan. His original plan was to gift the whole thing. But the tax situation in the laws changed, and that's why you have Exhibit 10 in 1998 saying, sorry, I can't gift it to you any longer. Now I'm gonna have to take principal payments, and then we come up with Exhibit 218, which they provided, which documents that in fact principal payments were received. And those were received after the marriage, and I think we all acknowledge here that equity created after the marriage is presumptively marital. So that's how I would respond to that.
All right, and so the value of the house at the time, I mean, did we have a value of the house at the time of the the purported transfer in 94 and at the time of the marriage?
The evidence that we have is the value of the note that he issued. There was some allusion into the record that maybe the house was worth $100,000 and that he had it appraised, but the appraisal was never offered into evidence.
Okay.
There was no foundation laid for that. So the only documentary evidence of value is the
$60,000. Okay.
All right. If there are no other questions on that issue, I think I might move on to a couple of the issues we raised in our brief. I see I'm pretty limited on time, so I don't mean to diminish the importance of the issues we raised if I can't get to them. We believe all of our issues are very important here. The first one I think I would like to raise deals with the advantage seed valuation. And I think there's two critical issues to discuss today. The first is that to do a market valuation, there needs to be a market for the business. There has to be somewhere for the business to be sold in order to appraise it as if it's being sold in an open and fair market. And there was no evidence at trial that a market existed for Mr. Knutson's business. Indeed, Danger, the expert appraiser, stated it was a unique business, all right, but testified that he was not aware of any market for it. And then he went on to testify that, well, if there's no market, then his report is irrelevant because—
What evidence would you expect to see that a market exists? I mean, his business existed and you know, earned some money. So what does that mean that there's, what would you expect? I mean, is it not reasonable to think that someone might in fact buy what he's doing if he's in fact doing it?
Well, I would expect evidence that other people were doing the same thing.
And why is that? Could there not be a market for a unique service?
There may or may not be.
And so what evidence is necessary such that it would, you know, be, clear error by the court to actually rely on this evaluation?
Well, the evidence necessary would be one, that there are other like businesses out there, or two, if there are not, that there's some enterprising individual or, you know, venture capitalist who are looking for these types of unique businesses to purchase. And there's no evidence that any of that exists. In fact, the business failed because he's being drowned out by Monsanto and the other businesses. So there frankly is no market. There was nowhere to sell it. And he himself, the Danger himself, says that a market is a necessary component of his valuation being probative. Additionally, the case law itself demands the existence of a market. None was produced here. And if you look at the record, when I was inquiring with Danger on it, Mr. Burkholz, in fact, objected to my inquiry on the issue and the court sustained it. So appellant herself has inflicted harm by disallowing any evidence that, in fact, the market existed for this type of business, a unique business that all parties acknowledge is unique. The other major error made by Danger and why his report was not admissible is he valued the business as if Mr. Knutson was going to remain. And Rogers is quite clear on that point, is that you cannot use that approach, period. You must value the business as if the spouse who's operating it has left. Whether that's factually going to be true or not, the business must be valued as if he has left, all right? And Danger did not do that here. In fact, on page 248 to 249 of the trial transcript, there's quotes from Mr. Danger's report that he assumes that management will continue with no changes. And under Rogers, whether it's the key man discount or the officer compensation, you just can't do that, period. It overvalues the business for marital dissolution purposes. The whole thing has to be tossed out.
Isn't this, though, a matter of the weight you give the report rather than its admissibility? Why not?
Because an expert report must comply with the components of Minnesota law. That's what Roger says. Minnesota requires X. If you don't do X, that's a major defect that requires reversal. The other case I'd cite for you is in a different context, but stands for the same principle. It's Poplar versus Wright Hennepin Electric Cooperative. And that case involved an expert using a damage analysis that didn't comport with Minnesota law on what the state allows for lost profit claims. And there, the expert didn't do the proper analysis. It wasn't then an issue of whether the expert's report needed weight or not. It was an erroneous report, and it was giving a report that was irrelevant because it didn't match up with Minnesota law. So the verdict there on the damages issue was reversed. It wasn't a weight issue.
So is your argument that that you objected to introduction of the expert testimony and report and the district court overruled? Is this an admission of the expert's report and testimony that you're challenging, or the findings based on?
It's all of it, Your Honor. The report should have never been admitted under 702. We made that motion to strike, I believe, during his testimony and also at the end of the trial. You'll see that at the end of the transcript, we made that motion. We made that argument in our proposed findings of fact, and we made that in our post-trial motions as well. Even if it were admissible, it still can't be relied upon with respect to the future business valuation because, again, the court has to apply the law, not what the expert thinks is appropriate. Minnesota law comes first.
All right. Thank you, counsel. I see your time has expired. Are there any other questions from the panel? All right. Thank you, counsel. Mr. Burkholz.
Thank you. I want to just quickly touch base. I think it's Exhibit 217 in regards to that house loan ledger I'm referencing. That was Exhibit 217. Exhibit 218 was a kind of quote unquote revised ledger of the same thing. And that ledger cites virtually every transaction and identifies every transaction as a gift in Sheldon Campbell's own hand. And that was testified to as well. And he only revised it later in his mind. This doesn't change the fact that all of these were gifts in their originality. That's consistent with all of the testimony. I think there's a hyper-selective approach of Mr. Sheldon Campbell's testimony on cross and not looking at all of it in its totality. But I'll move on. I think some of the other issues that we want to raise too is that there was some property that is not addressed and is just simply omitted by the district court. And I want to just make sure that that's clear because I think there may have been some confusion because the court should look at Schedule 5 of the expert report. I think originally I want to make sure that I made it into the record. That should be one of the last pages of the expert report. So that Schedule 5 lists in its valuation the items which of property that are included in the valuation. And specifically, the items that were not included in that valuation of the business were the scale and the seed cleaner and the trailer and the cash advances. That should be in my brief. So what the court seemed to hint at, it doesn't address it full on in the motion for amended findings, but I brought that issue up. I mean, I think if the court were to look at that, this is tens of thousands of dollars, not a trivial amount, certainly enough for a reversal. What that does is everything from Advantage was given to Mr. Knutson. So he got the benefit of an entire scale, an entire seed cleaner, which was bought over $60,000. Even Mr. Knutson testified that it was worth over $250,000 at one point and had an appraised value of $18,000, not in the schedule and not awarded. That's marital property. There's no dispute. It was bought during the marriage. It was paid in the marriage and it was on the depreciation schedules. Additionally, a small $2,000 trailer and that scale, I think, was originally at $30,000. I don't have the exact dollar in front of me. And a cash advance of $9,000. The court just simply omits that information in its findings, and it must be accounted for. We can't not account for that property. All of that was awarded to Mr. Knutson and needs to be distributed. The rent, it's probably a little opaque if you're looking at it just on paper. What happened originally, when you look at the first order and then the amended order, the court reawarded or altered the award of the real estate and then gave each party half an interest, and in turn then awarded half of the rent. It's just, it's not, I guess it's clear that they put the value on each person's column, but I want to make it very clear, and I think opposing counsel will concede, Mr. Knutson has all the rent, got all the rent. The court simply put it on Ms. Campbell's column, but she never got it. So, and because it's now on appeal, we couldn't raise that issue to the district court for enforcement. But I want to just make that clear, when what we're asking for on remand is that the court needs to make it clear that she is still entitled to those funds. Mr. Knutson got
it. Are you arguing that she is entitled to half of the rent after the valuation date of the farm?
No. Well, yes, because she was awarded half of it. So she has to be. She has her half interest.
Well, how do you respond, though? I believe the respondent in the cross appeal is claiming that that was an error.
What's an error?
That she got one half of the rent after the evaluation date.
Well, she was awarded half interest in the farm. It would be impossible for it to be an error. That was requested by Mr. Knutson. So he got, they each awarded half of the farm itself as an interest on the amended order. And then they got each half, got half of the rent that hadn't been paid, and the court didn't rule on what was paid after. But the fact that the court amended its order and awarded them both the asset, they just have to be awarded it. You can't double dip there.
Okay. So the half was due to her half ownership of the farm.
That's correct.
Okay.
And I think one thing that is in the reply brief, this whole expert report, I don't think it's, first of all, there was an opportunity to get a counter expert. One was never gotten. And the objection, if you look, was not to I don't believe it was to the admissibility, other than to say he was an expert, had all the expert qualifications, has a CV. All of his report, which was in the court's findings, were consistent with CPA rules, all the rules. There's no suggestion that all the rules weren't followed. So it's our opinion the report is admissible as evidence.
All right. Thank you, counsel. Anything else from the panel this afternoon? All right. The matter is submitted. We have taken it under advisement and will issue an order within the statutory time period. Thank you very much, counsel, for the submissions.